Our next presentation is from Dr. Skip Lenz. And I just have to say, I believe Dr. Skip is one of LDN's very best friends in the world because he has taken the lead in research, in assisting with these conferences, our videotaping, our LDN manuals that each one of you will receive today come from, with the compliments of Dr. Skip. And so I am so proud to have him here with us again, 2 years in a row, Dr. Skip Lenz.
Okay, if you were here last year, you know that I am blessed. My wife and my son know how to use computers, and so I go make it happen. Which one am I supposed to be using here? Okay, he says press escape. Can you do this? Can somebody come down and help the idiot? Yes, I take my sport coat off, loosen my tie, and we're going to get down and dirty now. I was supposed to email this to Susie, so I'm going to read it. I am biased. I own a compounding pharmacy. Okay, I make money selling LDN. Number one, understand that. Everybody understand that. I am biased. Two, I received an undergraduate degree in pharmacy from Mass College of Pharmacy in 1973. And so 20 some odd years later, I received my doctorate from the University of Florida, the NCAA national champions in basketball this year. Go Gators. There you go. In between that time, I spent some time at Harvard studying chemistry, and I spent some time at Nova Southeastern studying gerontology, getting terminal degrees. My professional career has been spotted in that I actually worked for, my friend Larry Frieders calls it the evil empire. I spent a lot of time doing research and development in the evil empire. I worked for a company and was responsible for helping develop a transdermal nitroglycerin that actually never came to market, but is the formula that most people are now using for transdermals. And also, I was hired by this company specifically to spend $1 million so they could get a tax benefit to sustained-release calcium carbonate. Now, during the last conference, we had a discussion about calcium carbonate. It's near and dear to my heart. I do research by setting up questions for students. I teach my students, I'm an adjunct or some sort of professor for the University of Florida, Nova, Southeastern, and Palm Beach Atlantic Schools of Pharmacy. The kids go there, they learn from the academicians, and then they come to our pharmacy and they learn what the real world is all about, okay? Dealing with the hormonal replacement women and MS patients, pain patients, and things like that. So, we do not accept any students in our pharmacy who are not going to be graduating summa cum laude. Okay, this is the creme de la creme of pharmacy students, and University of Florida is in the top 10 in the nation. These are really smart kids. They are major pains in my butt, okay, because they know a whole lot more about a whole lot more stuff than I do, okay? But it's a challenge. It's a challenge for them. I teach by the Socratic method. They hate that. That's the Socratic method. If you don't know what that means, is when the teacher doesn't know anything and he asks the questions, not the students. My students know they aren't supposed to ask me any questions. Anyway, We're going to be talking about two things today. One of them is calcium carbonate, okay, and the use of calcium carbonate as a filler. That is, you know, something that has come up several times today, and it came up last year. I wanted to be sure that what I was saying was accurate. Now, how do I get to the next slide? Anybody?
Space bar.
Okay. So our hypothesis was that when you increase, and it's really not a hypothesis, remember I told you I worked for this company and they paid us $1 million to sustain release calcium carbonate. So it really wasn't a hypothesis, but we had to set it up for the students, so it was a hypothesis. And the hypothesis was that if you increase the compaction of calcium carbonate, you will decrease the rate of dissolution, and decreased pH will increase dissolution rate. That was a throwaway. Okay, so what did we do? We actually filled capsules, actually the students hand-filled capsules with calcium carbonate. They hand-filled them because the way that a compounding pharmacist actually compounds naltrexone is with a machine. But that machine is very efficient, and a small amount of compaction goes a long way with the machine. Whereas with a hand-packed capsule, you've got to really punch it really hard, okay? So what we did is we had them make up 50 capsules at various different amounts of calcium carbonate. Those amounts were to mimic the compaction of the capsule itself. That's what that says. Okay, so we had a 90% capsule and pH. We want to vary the pHs because when you take a capsule, it's going to go into your stomach. Your stomach is a low pH. We wanted to see what was going to happen at the various and sundry pHs at the various and sundry times. Okay, so a 90% capsule contains 90% of what a hand-packed capsule will actually be. 100% is 100%. 110% is 110% of what an actual capsule should be packed at, hand-packed. There's actually going to be less calcium carbonate in this than if you do it with the machine. Okay, so pH 1 at 100 minutes, okay, 90% of the 90% one, most of it is in solution. It's not in, it's dissolved, the gelatin capsule has dissolved, and you now have calcium carbonate sitting there. The 100%, the solution is clear. Why that happened, I don't know. Why did 90% not clear up and 100%, I don't know. 110% was clear, okay, after 100 minutes of pH 1. So if you were to keep the capsule in your stomach for 100 minutes, it would be dissolved. That isn't what happens, okay? 45 minutes after you take it, the capsule is cleared. Okay, pH 4 at 0 minutes. You got capsules. They're in solution, or they're still maintained as a capsule, okay? The 110 sunk to the bottom. Oops, how do I go back?
Left arrow.
Or page up. Okay.
Can't find it.
No. This is an apple, too, on top of everything else.
Should I have this? Is that it?
pH at 100 minutes. Okay. That's good.
That's how to go back. That key right there.
That key right there. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Okay. So, pH 4, which is a little bit distal to the stomach. Capsule is not in solution, capsule hasn't dissolved, nothing's happened to that capsule. Now, in order for the drug to be absorbed, you've got to have that, like, number one there in the pH 1, where everything is in solution, everything is dissolved, because you really don't know. Okay, pH 4, 110%, the capsule stuck to the bottom of the container. This stuff is not going off. I'm not going to hopefully belabor this too much, okay? But as you can see, as we go down through, we're done. As you can see, as we go down through, these things are dissolving, and this is a big issue, okay? You talk about product failure. Well, the product could be failing not because the drug doesn't want to work or not because the body isn't going to work with the drug or for any other reason. The failure can be simply because the drug isn't getting into the body. Now, I have been a proponent of and will continue to be a proponent of and will never stop being a proponent of a fast...
Keep going.
Okay, of a fast... a fast fiber or a fast dissolving filler. There are two that I know of that'll work. Actually, now there are three because sucrose will work. Okay, I've got another.
There we go. Okay.
Okay, but I've got another one.
Oh, you have another?
Another presentation.
Okay.
Okay. Now what do I do?
Just
okay. I know, you're trying to make me look like a moron.
No, no, we were just reading your personal notes there, so I just thought I'd blank your screen for you.
Oh, okay, yeah. Thank you. Now I got to open the thing up, though. Okay, so there are three fillers that I strongly recommend. Filler number one is Avicel. Avicel is microcrystalline cellulose. We use microcrystalline cellulose in 100% of our low-dose naltrexone. It is a hypoallergenic filler. We also, as on our human side, we also do a lot of hypoallergenic compounding. So it's a no-brainer. It's a little bit more expensive than other fillers, but not enough to make anybody upset. The second one is lactose. Now, the problem with lactose is that there are people who are lactose intolerant. So we don't use lactose. And the third one is sucrose. Somebody mentioned this morning that sucrose could be used. Again, that wouldn't be my first choice. My first choice is Avicel. But as you can see, this is the reason why there was a controversy last year, but you can see that these things aren't dissolving. My issue, product failure, okay? Is the product failing because the person is not going to respond to the drug, or is the product failing because the person doesn't have the drug? There was an issue brought up about transdermal, okay? And again, if back to my history, I did some transdermal work and actually got paid for it. There is a model, there's a formula that one uses when one deals with transdermals on the size and shape of the molecule that you can use transdermally. Naltrexone fails that model. I have a pretty good friend whose son is autistic, and for 2 or 3 years he fought with me, and I just said no, because I am one of those types of compounders that this is my business, this is what I know, and if it is something that's not appropriate, I'm not going to do it. Well, finally he twisted my arm and said, I want you to do it. I called that pharmacy. The key to the thing is the Inu oil. My target side effect, and we're going to talk about side effects, but my target side effect is sleep disturbances. If you get sleep disturbances, then you're absorbing the naltrexone. His boy got sleep disturbances 2-3 days later with the Inu oil. It's not just the standard PLO formula. It is there, you use Inu oil. So if you're going to go, if you want to do the transdermal product, make sure it's Inu oil that your pharmacist is using. That's more expensive than the soy lecithin part of the PLO that most people use all the time. So your pharmacist is going to have to get pure Inu oil. Underline, pure, not the stuff that you can get at GNC. Okay, I don't know where they get their Inus, but, you know, I think they have moral issues or something. You want the pure Inu oil. That's important, okay? And like the doctor said, if you call this guy, he's going to give you the formula for it, okay? It's a little bit different than the standard formula. Don't take the standard formula. It doesn't work. Okay? The kids do not get the sleep disturbances 3 days, 4 days later. Okay? Again, that's my target. Okay? Are there any questions about that? Yes.
What do you mean, don't use a standard formula? You mean the one
there,
with the PLO?
There's a, compounders use a standard formula. We call it a PLO gel.
Okay.
Okay? It's pleuronic lecithin organogel. Okay? It's a pleuronic, and there is a soya-based oil phase to it. We use that for hormone replacement therapy. We use that for pain. We use that for methimazole. We use it for just about everything. We make up about 3 liters of that solution on a weekly basis. That's how much transdermals that we do. It doesn't work. Okay? Again, that target is sleep disturbances. The drug may or may not work. Okay? Let's be frank about that. But if you don't get the sleep disturbances, you don't know whether it's working. You don't know whether it's in the system. It has to be in the system. Okay? Oh, come on. Last time there was a big discussion about this. Now, we're going to watch Skip try to open up the computer again. Are you going to... Oh, you're a good man.
I'll go ahead and ask you a question.
Yes.
Do you always use gelatin as the capsules?
We use veggie caps. It's not made out of animal gelatin.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so. It's LVN slides.
Because how that dissolves is also going to affect the...
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Yes.
Okay.
Okay. That is going to dissolve first. I don't know of a gelatin cap, except maybe a animal-based gelatin cap that's going to have some issues with it. But a veggie cap, they dissolve in air. They dissolve in air in South Florida when we have a 50 or 60% humidity. Trust me on that one, okay?
So LDN is absorbed in the stomach?
Pardon me?
Is it absorbed through the stomach then?
There's
the
very few things that are absorbed in the stomach themselves.
Okay.
Okay. It's probably absorbed somewhere down the line.
Okay.
But it has
to
dissolve.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to interrupt. I'm going to ask folks not to come down and take those books right now, but wait till the end of the conference. Thank you. We're also going to ask for donations for those books.
I mean, where's
so if we can leave
dissolve?
Them there for now, that would
Pardon?
Be great.
Where does the veggie cap dissolve?
Veggie cap dissolves in the stomach.
Okay, but the drug is absorbed further down the line. That and it's not destroyed by the stomach acids then?
No.
Okay.
No. And again, there are very few. When you get an enterocoated tablet or capsule, that's to prevent it from being attacked by the gastric juices. Okay? Yes.
When you start to see the sleep disturbances, does that eventually subside?
Yes.
And how long typically?
We're gonna talk about that next, okay? But yeah, that is, you know, that's what I use. That's when, and we probably have 5,000 or 6,000 LDN patients now. Okay. My last count, which was a week and a half ago, we've done 250,000 patient months since 1999. Okay, some come, some go. Okay. Last week I got 185 telephone calls on LDN, and I can tell you what the question is. What filler do you use? Okay, I'm getting sick of that one. Okay, you know, it's like I'm the guy that started this controversy. You know, I use Abacel. Okay. And am I going to have any side effects? I don't know, you know.
Can I just really quickly,
yes.
Just to confirm then, it is definitely theoretically very possible that the, say like in my mom's breast cancer case, that she wasn't getting the LDN.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Definitely theoretically possible, yes. I would actually, if she had calcium carbonate, I can say that she wasn't getting it, okay? And I would debate anybody on that issue. Yes.
Thank you.
So before we move on from fillers,
yes.
I was educated by our conversations last year when I got to sit with you and the other pharmacists to talk about fillers, and I realized that the reason why my symptoms of IBS were coming back, they had been back for about 3 weeks, was I had just started a new bottle of LDN that was given to me by a pharmacy.
Yes.
And what they didn't tell me was that they had changed fillers.
Yes.
They had changed to, forgetting the name of the...
Acidophilus?
No.
Yeah.
Lactose. Thank you. I'm just blanking on the name. Yeah. They had changed to lactose.
Yes.
And my symptoms of IBS were returning.
Yes.
So I asked them to switch it to Avicel.
Yes.
And I have not had trouble since. Yeah. So one of the things that emerged in our conversation last year at the other conference was that perhaps many people who take LDN and who have autoimmune diseases, this is not the population that you want using that filler.
Yes. Yeah.
Lactose. Using lactose.
Yeah. Lactose is still a fast filler, and there's still a population that could take it. I don't like making more than one thing at a time, though. You know, I don't want to have five different naltrexones. And this is a business decision. I don't want to have the lactose in-house. I don't want to have to make lactose filled. Okay? Again, that's a business decision. But that business decision, and I'm biased because I make money on LDN, okay, but that business decision is based on, this isn't rocket science here, okay? And during that conversation, it came out, one of the pharmacists said, well, I'm going to do whatever the doctor says to do, okay? And for those of you who have spoken to me, you know that I firmly believe that I am the expert in this area. Okay, and if the doctor asks me for something stupid, I probably won't say you're stupid, but they'll get that impression after our conversation. I just won't do it. The answer is just absolutely no. Okay, won't do it. Now, there is one young lady that I know of, okay, who is, to my mind, an honest and upright young person, okay, who is allergic to Avicel. She was getting headaches. One person that I know, honestly, okay? If there were more than one person, I would investigate more, okay? She doesn't have a paper allergy, and microcrystalline cellulose is paper, okay? So, and it's hypoallergenic. One of the big hypo docs in Florida uses us exclusively, and, you know, he's really, really, really anal retentive about this, okay? So don't take anything other than Avicel. If you have failures, if you have patients who have failures, if you have friends and relatives who have failures, doesn't necessarily mean it's the drug. Okay? And if you failed orally, I would absolutely go to the transdermal. That's a real slick way of doing it. Now, if you put the transdermal on your thumb or on your heel and rub it into the person, you're not going to absorb it. You won't have sleep disturbances or anything else. The thumb is the second thickest skin on your body, and the heel is the first. If you can put it on your heel and do that, good luck. Have fun. Call me and tell me about that. This is a picture of my sailboat. How that got on there. Okay, so what do? Just go like this?
Yeah. Skip, could I ask you just one question more about calcium carbonate?
Yes.
I'm a little puzzled. I'm not expert in chemistry as you are. But calcium carbonate is the same thing as in Tums tablets.
Absolutely.
And they seem to dissolve or crumble in people's stomachs.
Absolutely.
And why do you blame the failure to dissolve on the calcium carbonate, which is inside the gelatin, instead of perhaps the gelatin's impervious to the acid?
Okay. The gelatin capsule is going to dissolve.
But you showed us it was on the bottom and it didn't dissolve.
Right. That was on a higher pH, it's not going to be dissolving in the stomach, okay? But what happens is that you use a device to compress the calcium, okay? A calcium carbonate tablet is, one, compressed at about 12 pounds per square inch, and there is a fast dissolving agent that goes in that, okay? prior to that. It's actually what the flavoring is made out of. It's a twofer. You get a flavor and it dissolves quicker.
Also, to be fair, I do remember on the label, it says chew
yeah,
before swallowing the yeah. Tums. Do not just swallow intact. Yeah. So they must be aware of a trouble crumbling.
Yeah. If you compress at greater than, and it's been a while, but I think it's 13 pounds per square inch, you got concrete. You got solid. It isn't going through. It's the end of the story. We did clinicals at Butler from that company. And some of the tablets pass through unmolested by any parts of the body, okay? And were presented to us as such, okay? But that's another story altogether.
Skip, I'm sorry, you mentioned lactobacillus, but you didn't pass a judgment.
Acidophilus. Larry Frieders, who is another compounder, a colleague, and a friend who was here last year, he uses Acidophilus. He's gotten some of his people, some of his docs, to write that way. I believe that's another drug. So we don't use Acidophilus, but Larry does. Okay? I have a lot of respect for Larry and his ability, so I put that out there. Okay? Okay. Side effects. That's the other thing that we talk about in or the telephone calls that I get are side effects. Again, this is an anecdotal study. You're gonna see the questions that we asked. Okay, the questions were quite similar to the efficacy study that we did last year. We didn't talk to doctors. We talked to people. We talked to the people who were taking the drug. And having been part of clinical studies, I know it's not double-blinded and it's not scientifically rigorous and everything else, okay? I'm a duck guy. If it looks like a duck and it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck and it lives with ducks and it has eggs, it's probably a duck. Now, I could be wrong. It could be a platypus. I doubt it. Okay, hit it. Okay. Again, some of the questions that I get are, what are the side effects? Okay? Why are people DCing? Why are people coming off of these drugs? Are they coming off of these drugs because of side effects or for some other reason? And what we did is we designed the study, and again, my students designed the study. I asked the questions, the students designed the study. Why? Why did you come off? Why did you stop taking? Okay, we generated a list from 6105 to 123105, okay, of all of our new patients. It was randomized, and I don't have a clue how they did it. They put it on a program, and they pressed a button, and they got randomized. And why they randomized them, I don't know, because they were calling and asking questions. But these are students, and they're smart students. We asked a list of questions, which we're going to go through. The list, the students actually asked the questions and listened to the answers. And then I and one of our other pharmacists sat down and looked at the answers and put them in an order that we think is appropriate. Here are the questions. One, are you still taking naltrexone? If yes, are you experiencing any side effects? If yes, what are they? If no, what reasons did you stop taking the drug? And did you have any side effects? The interesting thing is that there were some people that had no side effects and said, well, what should I be expecting? I skipped one. There we go. So we had a total of 545 patients on the list. 177 of them did not respond. We called 545 patients. 177 of them didn't respond to the message. That we either they weren't interested, they didn't want to talk to us. Which is really interesting because the last survey we did, we had about a 90% response to it. 113 we were unable to contact. Either their telephone numbers had changed, they didn't answer their phone. So we contacted 255 patients successfully. 80 patients discontinued the use of naltrexone, and 175 patients still use naltrexone. Okay, so 80 patients stopped taking it for one reason or another, and 175 continued to take it. Patients not contacted. Now, what we did was we took that 545 number or 555 number, and we backed up into our computer base and to see if they were still taking naltrexone, and we just didn't hear from them for one reason or another. 273 of those were current with their prescriptions. So if they got a 30-day supply, if they had that prescription refilled within a couple days of the 30 days, then we knew they were current. Okay, so 273 of them were current. 17 of them were not current. Side effects. Number one on the hit parade, sleep disturbances. 51% of the patients had sleep disturbances. That's why we use this as a marker. Okay? If more than half of the people are having sleep disturbances, then we know that they're getting the drug. Stiffness. Now, our population is basically made up of MS patients to a great extent. 25% of them had stiffness. 6% had headaches, 6% had GI disturbances, 3% had gait disturbances, and 9% had other. And they ranged, the other was an interesting thing. Okay. Okay, now I just keep on.
Hit spacebar until you get back.
Back to where I am. These are the questions. First set of results. Okay. These are the side effects patients that discontinued. So these were side effects that the discontinued patients had. 49% had sleep disturbances. 25% had stiffness. 13 had headaches. 13 had headaches, 13 had GI disturbances, and there was other. There was an interesting number that came up that out of the 80 patients, 24 of them actually, they had side effects, but 24 of the 80 patients actually stopped taking the drug because their doctor told them to stop taking their drug. I wish we had more Irish doctors here, I guess. Okay, so how many side effects did each patient have? You know, were we just talking about one, you know, the sleep disturbance thing? 19 patients on the LDN had one side effect. 8 of the patients that discontinued had one. And 7 of the patients still on LDN had 2. You know, you scratch your head when you get these numbers. I do, anyway. Okay, so this is the interesting number. There were 0.183 side effects, which is sort of a stupid number, but people in research use these numbers. 0.183 incidents per patient still using the naltrexone, but only 0.1 that have discontinued it. So people who are staying on it will experience more side effects than people who will come off of it. Okay, now what happened?
Did you hit spacebar?
Yeah, I hit spacebar. Am I done, Adam?
You're done.
I'm done. Okay.
Close the cover,
huh? The side effect thing, okay? Again, number one on the hit parade is sleep disturbances. Next year for the third annual conference, we're going to present, you know, how long these side effects go on. My gut feeling from talking to patients is that it lasts only maybe a couple of weeks at the most. I had one lady that it lasted a month. But she was feeling so good during the day that she didn't care if she was having sleep disturbances. Now, for those of you who don't take LDN, I'm colorblind. That's another one of the issues with the computer and everything else. I'm colorblind, and I've started taking LDN, and I'm seeing colors in my dreams. Okay, now, I'm a sailor, you saw my sailboat, so discount what I say by 50%, okay? You should actually discount all these numbers by 50% because I am a sailor. But it is significant to me that a person who is, and I'm really hard-nosed when it comes to these types of things, that this is an issue and this does happen, okay? So be aware of that, you know. When you write the prescription or when you're talking to people, tell them, yeah, you're going to have sleep disturbances. It's going to be for a while, but you're going to feel fantastic during the day, okay? One of the questions that I have is, are we making this the silver bullet for every disease there is? And I talked to Dr. Gluck about that. That's a concern. I am concerned that the establishment will come down on people because they're saying it's going to solve everybody's problem. It doesn't solve everybody's problem, okay? I don't really care what the establishment says. You know, look at me. You know, that's not in my realm. But it's important that somewhere down the pike that it becomes an accepted drug, because this drug, literally in my 30-some-odd years of practicing pharmacy and doing research, is one of the, if not the most significant drug that I've ever run into. The things that I hear, it's really nice for me. It's a real ego thing. Oh, Skip, you're so wonderful. I'm taking the naltrexone and I feel so much better. And, you know, well, it's not about me. It's about the drug. But it's a really nice thing to hear. And it's over and over and over again. So, questions about side effects? Yes, sir.
Skip, could you go back? I don't
know.
No. Not on the slide, but you must know the number. It was a little confusing. I remember on some of your slides, there was a large circle. It was divided into several segments. It almost gave the impression that everybody had side effects. But when you came to the end, there was 0.18 something.
Yeah, point one eight of the 255. Yeah, zero. I'm sorry, 0.1. Yeah. If I can open this sucker up again, or if I can have an able assistant,
I'll get it back. Yeah.
That number is something that we use in research and development. Okay, it's a nonsensical number. Other than the number of incidents per patient, okay? So look at it a different way. For every 10 patients, you know, you're going to get 1.8 side effects in the beginning, okay?
This is a percent, so this is...
That's the number of incidences, 0.183 incidents per patient. Again, unless you're in research, it's a nonsensical number.
But let's multiply it by 10.
Yeah, 1.83 per 10 patients.
So there's almost two side effects for every 10 people. Is that what you're saying?
There are side effects for 1.8 side effects per 10 people. Not multiple, just side effects.
Right. Not quite two side effects in every 10 people.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
Can you go to a lower dose for a while and then come back up to the 4.5?
Okay. Now, that's also an interesting thing. The protocol that we use, and Dr. Brian Steingo in Florida was the one that started this because he was seeing these side effects, and I obviously have to agree with him. What we do, okay, if you were to call or if a patient were to call and say, how do we do it? We start you off at 1.5 milligrams at bedtime for 30 days. And then you go to 3 milligrams at bedtime for 30 days. And then you go to 4.5 milligrams at bedtime thereafter. That avoids the side effects. There was actually a graph here that we tried to create that we couldn't, that had the incidence of the doses per, or the number of people who had side effects using that protocol, which was 1, versus people who had started at 3 and who had started at 4.5. Are you going to find it for me?
I'm just trying to get this back up. I don't know why it's not doing it.
I touched it. Yes.
What do you think about giving it in the morning like Dr. Smith was doing?
There was actually a study done in Germany a couple years ago. Dr. Moss, I think, was it? Dr. Meir. And for some reason, they were giving it in the morning time, and he had a tremendous failure rate. So I believe that at bedtime is the best time to do it. Now, what I recommend is at bedtime. And if you go to bed at 7 o'clock in the morning, well, that's bedtime for you. Okay? If you go to bed at 11 o'clock at night, that's bedtime for you. Be consistent with that.
I have to interject something. It happened to come up several times in Dr. Bihari's practice, and we know the outcomes, where people worked at night. And Bernie made the point that he knew it was peculiar, but it doesn't matter when you're active, when you're sleeping. Please take it between 9 p.m. and 3 a.m. And the patients did continue to take it in that time span and had great success with the LDN. Apparently, the cycling
doesn't change.
Isn't paying attention to the fact that you're working at night. That time span is the important period when, if you take the blocker, which LDN is, at that time, then you interfere with what is called the pre-dawn phenomenon, when most of your endorphins for the day are made. You may remember an early bar chart that was up where a lot of the endorphins were there.
Right.
Yeah. So you just have to stick with that time zone.
Okay.
Yeah, after 9, before 3 a.m.
I can go with that.
Okay.
Yes.
How, since we haven't gone through, I'm sorry, I'm a scientist at heart, did a lot of health research, consulted to a lot of pharmaceutical companies, which I know is a bad word around here. Since there's no phase 1-2 two trials with this, how do we know the upper limits of normal of the dose? For
we don't.
You know, 4.5, maybe 6 work better, 10 would work better.
Yep. You're absolutely right. We absolutely don't know what the upper limit is.
Okay.
What we really need is for some fat cat drug company to come down and say, okay, we're going to do a nice thing and actually do a clinical study. That's what we need to have done. Up until that time, you're going to have yutzes like me generating data like this, okay? And we're going to go with it, okay? And you know what? If I embarrass drug companies, oh, well, too bad, you know?
But Dr. Skip, is there a point where it gets too high that you're reversing the initial intent?
You know what? We've got a couple people on 6 milligrams because that's what they wanted, and I didn't see any reason not to, and their doctor and I had a conversation about it, and they were big people, and, you know, and I don't actually know what that outcome is. I don't know what the target dose.
Some people were experimenting with 25 milligrams.
I don't know what the target dose is. I don't know. You know, let's get a drug company to do some studies here.
Dr. Glock, do you know?
Pardon me?
I'm asking Dr. Glock what Dr. Bihari's theory is on the dosage.
Yeah, the hypothesis is that, just keep in mind what the naltrexone does. The naltrexone is blocking all the opioid receptors, and that's how it does its trick. If you blocked all opiate receptors all day long, you were a heroin addict, and you shot up in the afternoon or any time, the heroin would not be received because the receptors are blocked. So what you're balancing is length of blockade against the endorphins that in any case are going to be increased because you're blocking the receptors. So to say it more simply, you can reach a point past 4.5 or 5 milligrams where the receptor blockade is too lengthy, and you don't have the advantage then of receiving the increased levels of endorphins that you've produced by taking the medicine. So the longer you put the blockade there, the less endorphin activity you're going to benefit from. And that's why the range has been, how should I put it, anecdotally worked out with a lower limit of 1.5 and an upper limit of 4.5. But it's true there are people who can function at 5 and 6.
I have to disagree, because more drug may not lengthen the amount of blockade. Once you've blockaded all that's available, giving more drug is not going to increase the time of blockade.
It lasts in the body longer.
And this dialogue is exactly the reason why we need a drug company to step in and to do the work.
Yeah, because what percent at 4.5 milligrams, what percent of the receptors are blockaded? If you reached 100%, you can give 100 milligrams and it's not going to block anymore. And it's not going to lengthen the time, because what's the dissolution? How long is it going to take for it to dissolve? Once the ones that are blockading no longer work, can others step in, or is it already gone in the bloodstream? So you don't know.
That's right.
Dr. Skip, could I just comment on that point?
Sure.
I'm not familiar with the literature I'm about to request, but we have to remember that this is derivative from a licensed drug at 50 milligrams dose for alcohol and drug addiction. Mm-hmm. Therefore, there must be in some dusty files somewhere some things like trials on normal people at various dose levels, some studies on persistence in the body with sophisticated chemical measurements, and so on.
Yeah.
So if this audience or its friends would somehow be able to trace back to the data that were derived in the original drug application or academic studies, at least at high doses, how was 50 determined to be the dose for the licensed drug? That perhaps 20 was tried, 50, 100, and so on. There'd be some data available to answer some of these questions.
Okay, what we're looking at, though, and this is the dialogue that's going on, okay, what we're looking at is we're not looking at the same sort of dynamic and kinetic at a high dose versus the low dose. That's going to be different. That is different. Because if you took 50 milligrams of this, you should be a real happy guy. Your MS symptoms should all go away. You know, life should be wonderful, but that isn't what happens. So there's a different dynamic that's going on down here at the low dose, that until we can get, you know, somebody other than a guy sitting in a pharmacy doing this sort of clinical research, it ain't going to happen. Okay, we are always going to be coming back to these meetings, and we're always going to be saying the same thing. Okay? And that comes down to buckos. Way back there.
One comment and one question. On the websites, again, on the chat rooms, there's people who are taking 10 milligrams or even 25 milligrams as soon as they feel an exacerbation coming on and have tremendous success with it, that they say, you know, 2 days later, I'm not sure if they're just happy and whatever, but they say that it actually stops it. So there's just a handful of people who have done that. Again, it's not proven anything, but it has happened. And I was wondering, what do you do with the dosage if you go overseas? For example, we have an Irish person there, we have Greek. I have to go to Germany in the summertime. And if you're staying there for a longer time, not only a two-week vacation, but really like a month or two, what should you do with the LDN? When should you take it? How is your system?
You shift to the time zone that you're in. That's the best answer that's been given so far. When you go to a new time zone, you shift to the time zone you're in.
So you do it instantly? If it's like 6
hours?
Yes,
you do it that day. That's right.
Okay, thanks.
I like that answer. That's an easy answer. Yes.
I just want to go back to your – I wish we could bring it up on the screen, but we can't for some reason. So I just want to go back to your – one of your stats was the pie chart with the around 50% experiencing sleep disturbances.
Yeah,
I just want to clarify
51
something.
51 for the people that stayed on it and 49 for the people
right.
that came off. Yeah.
So when I saw that initially, I thought what that meant was, 50% of people who take low-dose naltrexone have sleep disturbances. That's not what that means, is it? It's 50% of the people who report a side effect. That's 50%
yes.
of those people.
Yes.
They report a sleep disturbance.
Yes.
So what percent of people report any side effect?
Out of this study?
So when you ask the people who take naltrexone, low-dose naltrexone,
how many
do you
of them
experience
reported,
a side effect?
How many? Those numbers are deep in here, right
here.
And I give you the exact number. Ask the question again, so.
Ask the question again?
Yeah.
So when you ask someone in your survey, mm-hmm. Someone who's currently taking LDN, mm-hmm. Have you experienced a side effect?
A real quick number off the top of my head, okay? It's 255 patients responded. 0.18 on the high end, okay? Those are the people who stayed on it, which was 175. So 17 patients reported one side effect.
Okay. Yeah. So,
not very much.
Right.
Okay.
Because the initial pie charts made it look like, whoa.
Yeah.
Of
the people who reported side effects, but these were what the side effects were. That's what that data meant.
Right. Okay.
I've got to get a statistician because the same thing happened last year.
Okay.
Yes,
thanks.
Ma'am.
Why do you think the emu oil drives the LDN through the skin, and will it drive other agents like ALA through the skin too?
ALA.
Alpha lipoic acid.
I don't know why the emu oil, I mean, I really didn't even know what an emu was, okay, until I found out what it was and found out what the oil was. It's a solubilizing agent. It's probably more fat soluble. And for some reason, it latches onto the naltrexone, because that's really what happens here. You have a fat-soluble and a water-soluble, and the naltrexone gets attached to both ends of that and gets sucked through the skin. Now, we can actually go through the pharmacodynamics of that, but you guys will be sound asleep by the time we're done now. For some reason, the emu is better. I think another thing is because the other oil base that we use is that soya product, and a lot of people, you know, with the autism have an issue with soya and don't mess with it if it's not broken. It's got to be pure emu oil from pure virginal emus, I guess. I don't know what they, because there, you know, the funny thing is there's no analytical procedure that shows purity, but we buy it from a very good company. Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry, are you saying emu as in the flightless bird? Or
yeah, emu, like the little things that run around.
Okay, and that's what we were trying to figure
emu,
out. Thank you.
E-M-U, yeah, emu. Yeah, those guys. They're Australian, yes.
Do you know if there's a patent on LDN until 2025? Is that true, or is that just...
I don't care.
That was my second question. Does
I don't,
it matter?
I don't.
But does that affect... Does
didn't Dr. Bahari get some use patents on it?
Is that an issue with...
Yes, every clinical effect that he would discover, he would try to obtain a use patent, and he has several use patents, and he has also patents pending.
Yeah.
But they're all use patents. They're not...
Those patents have been busted by all of us anyway, and, you know, so it's not...
Perhaps.
That's what I was wondering.
Perhaps.
25, I doubt very much. I don't even think it's way too long, unless they patented a new... molecular structure. That isn't going to happen. If there's a new use patent, I don't care. Sue me.
Okay.
That would... I literally sue me. Please.
Just a warning. We're nearing the end of our Q&A period. You have a few more minutes, but I'm also going to suggest that we take a very quick stretch break just because we're getting near the middle of the afternoon or end of the afternoon. So maybe one or two more questions, then we'll take a quick break.
Okay.
Skip, I enjoyed your talk very much, and listening to the comments in the audience, I was just wondering if compounding pharmacists like yourself belong to a society, an association.
Yes.
Do you all meet and compare information or share information to help each other in this particular field, since it's so important?
Yeah, there is the International Academy of Compounding Pharmacists that I belong to, and I ascribe to their... they're the fundamental principles, but I don't go because they're in this is an indictment on pharmacy and on compounding pharmacy. There's a lot of times all I want to do is go and talk about how we can make more money. And I'm not, my accountant hates me, my wife hates me, my son hates me about this, but that's not what I'm about here. You can make money doing the right thing. That's my moral position on it. But
I didn't know if by sharing information like these, the study that you did, if yeah. your entire group did.
Oh, well, the study from last year is sitting on Larry Frieder's desk right now. And when he gets his ball-headed butt together and actually reads the thing, that will be published. This one will go to him very shortly, and that will be published. We'll be co-authors on that. He does the review on it and makes sure, you know, like this chart thing, he'll clean that all up so people can actually understand what I meant to say. Okay? But, yeah, it'll be published in our journal. Yeah. Pardon me?
Could you mention the name of the journal?
Yeah, it's the Journal of the International Academy of Compounding Pharmacists.
Okay, so let's thank Dr. Skip Lenz.